We're coming to this continuation of our class on the Bhagavad science of mind, in which we are basically focusing on the subject that is in the West goes under the name of psychology, but our reference is Vedic, the Vedic Shastra in particular, most of all the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, in today's class, we are going to look at what is known in Western terminology as depth psychology. So let me give a definition of that term. This is a quotation from a book. Quote, "The exponents of depth psychology have compared our mind to the tip of an iceberg floating on the surface of water. A large part of the iceberg is under the water level, and only a small portion of it is visible to the naked eye. The portion of the iceberg which is visible to us is just 1/8 of the entire body of ice. Hence, 7/8 part thereof is submerged and cannot be seen." So for your information, depth psychology in the West was pioneered by Carl Gustav Jung, who lived from 1875 to 1961. Nitai Gauranga Prabhu, who has left us for some days to go to Europe, he's already, if you had attended a class in which he spoke of Jung, then you would know something about him, but either to refresh your memory or to inform you, if you weren't here, that early in his career, Jung was Sigmund Freud's foremost disciple. But he broke with his teacher to establish his own school. And one of the reasons that he broke was largely because of Freud's obsessive atheism, which Jung did not appreciate. And there were other reasons. In 1912, he published The Psychology of the Unconscious, which is still a groundwork for the depth psychologists of today. Jung was considerably influenced by the picture of the mind that the sage Patanjali gives in his Yoga Sutras. Patanjali, of course, derived his schema or picture of the mind from Vedic sources. So the Western version of depth psychology is typically eclectic. It can be characterized as a New Age discipline, almost a contradiction in terms, since New Age ideas are not known for adhering to disciplined thinking. Today's depth psychologists freely bring in mythology, drug experiences, ESP, shamanism, and sheer fantasy to their work of probing into the hidden inner region of mental structures and processes. So in other words, that which goes in the West under the name of depth psychology accepts that the portion of our mind that we're using, often they give this biophysical example. I don't know if it's really true or not, but it is said by someone, some authorities, that the human being only uses 10% of his brain. You might have heard that. It's often quoted. Now again, I'm not commenting on the veracity of that. I've come across controversies over that, whether or not that is really scientific, I don't know. But anyway, that illustrates their conception that as Western psychology takes the brain to be the center of the mind, then we're only using in our conscious awareness only about 10% of the apparatus of the brain. Hence, there is 90% that is either not being used, or the depth psychologists would say 90% of mental functions we're not aware of, we don't have access to. There's something going on. It's not that it's just lying dead, unused. But there's something that is going on a deeper level. And we do not have rational access to that. So this, which we're aware of now, is only a small portion of the total potential of the mind. And so in depth psychology in the West, they attempt by different means to try to probe into what Freud called the unconscious, or what Srila Prabhupada, he used the term subconscious. I like that term better, not only because Prabhupada used it, but because it unconscious tends to mean there's no consciousness, but subconscious means below the level of consciousness there's another level. So yes, again, depth psychologists, because they figure that the unconscious or subconscious is not amenable to rational exploration by means of normal scientific methods. So they use all kinds of different methods that they just make up on the way. There was, I remember this, what was his name? Arthur Genoff, I think. He introduced something called primal scream therapy, where you tried to reach that unconscious portion of the mind by screaming. And so you just sit there for, I don't know how long, an hour or two, and just scream your lungs out. And this was supposed to bring you to some deeper level. So anyway, the germ of depth psychology in the West is Vedic knowledge, because as we said, the father of depth psychology is Jung. And Jung was very much influenced by yoga. Not that he agreed with everything in the Patanjali or Astanga yoga system, but he did admire a lot of it and incorporate a lot of it into his own model of the mind. And Astanga yoga is of course derived from Vedic knowledge. Vedic knowledge is not merely some sort of working hypothesis like Western depth psychology that, all right, well, there's this region of the mind that's not accessible to ordinary science, so let's today all take 250 micrograms of LSD and see if we can see, or something else, see if we can get to that deeper part of the mind. No, it's not some working experimental hypothesis. The image of an iceberg, that 1/8 of the mind is visible above the watery surface, 7/8 is hidden below, is a useful entry into our understanding of the Vedic description of the mind. What is hidden is not open to our own speculative interpretation. We can't give shape to the hidden part of the mind simply by making it up. The hidden mind is formed of very real and powerful energies of the Supreme Lord. And we've already discussed Srila Prabhupada's allusion to this very Vedic model of the mind, in which he gave the example of a pond. So the pond has its surface, and on the surface things are reflected. A pond will reflect, of course, the trees and whatever happens to be on the surface around the pond. But the pond has its depth, and from the depth, as Prabhupada pointed out, sometimes bubbles are seen to rise up from the bottom and burst on the surface. And Prabhupada explained that that means that something is fermenting underneath, some vegetable matter or whatever that is fallen into the pond, has gone down to the bottom, and there it's fermenting or rotting, in other words, and producing some gas, and then the gas is rising in the form of bubbles. And the bubbles are bursting in the surface. So this is Srila Prabhupada's explanation of what is technically known as the vasanas. The vasanas are the subconscious desires which come from deep within. They're actually implanted there by two sources, by previous impressions, which are known as samskaras, previous experiences that we've had, and also previous things that we've done, the karmans. There's also another name which I've forgotten right now. It's not found in Srila Prabhupada's book, so it's not that important. But I found it in my readings in Vedic astrology. But there's a specific term that refers to things that we have done. So things that we have experienced, things that have, in other words, have been done to us, or experiences we have gone through, are one sort of vasanas, and things that we have, acts that we have performed, are another source. These impress the deeper part of the mind as samskaras. Samskaras means impressions. And the impressions come to the surface of the mind in the form of vasanas, which are just like these bubbles. And the vasanas break into the surface of the mind as urges, as in particular, as dreams. We have strange imagery appearing in our mind practically every night in the form of dreams. They're not logical. But the important thing is that while we're dreaming them, we're accepting them as real, because they're very potent. So these all have their source in previous experiences or previous actions, which are buried deep in our subconscious. So Bhagavatam, fourth canto, explains that as long as the mind, our mind, continues to be, what's called, the term is guna pravaha. Guna pravaha means as long as the mind is under the influence of the three modes of nature, as long as the mind continues to be agitated by the three modes, then these vasanas will continue to pop into the mind. You see? Another common term, deja vu. This is, you're somewhere and suddenly you get this creepy sensation that, oh, I've been here before. So that present situation is reminding you of something that happened sometime in the past. There's an association going on. Your present conscious mind is associating with something that is buried in the subconscious. Now, whether or not you were in that exact place at some time previous, in a previous lifetime, that's not really so important. What's important is that there is some previous experience, some previous samskara, which your conscious mind is somehow resonating with. And that there's enough resemblance between what you're experiencing now and that which you experienced then, that you have this strange feeling that I've been here before. Whether or not you've been there before, that's really beside, you know, that's... we'll never be able to answer that question. But it does indicate that something similar to this present experience is buried in the subconscious. And somehow the conscious mind is getting an echo of it. So in these ways, the vasanas, they appear in our mind. Vasanas meaning, again, the subconscious desires or impressions. So that's again referring to this example Srila Prabhupada gave, that suddenly on its own the mind becomes disturbed by some desire or some impression which is just coming up from underneath. And there's no clear rational explanation for it. So I'm going to offer now a simple outline of the structure, the deep structure of the mind, as it is described in Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vaishnava Vedanta sources. I have to thank His Holiness Banu Maharaj for much of the way this diagram is, if that's what you call a diagram or organogram, I think that's another term used, the way that this has been organized. The scriptural references you can see on the right side. So let me now just go over here and explain this. So here we start with... Now I want to remind you again that what we're presenting here can be understood both macrocosmically and microcosmically. So this is put together from descriptions of both given in Srimad Bhagavatam. So there's a correlation between the structure of the greater universe and the structure of our own psyche. So we begin with Paramatma. So Paramatma, of course, we understand to be the Lord in our own heart. But Paramatma also refers to the Purusha avatars, of whom Chirdaksha Vishnu, Paramatma, is the last. But he is not different from Garbhodakasha Vishnu, who lies at the bottom of the universe, who is not different from Mahavishnu, out of whom the universe comes. So all three are described clearly in Shastra as being non-different from one another, so all three can be understood as Paramatma, the Supreme Soul. So there's Paramatma, and then there is his Shakti, known as Kala, the time energy. Kala Shushiksha is the term that is used. And so here the Bhagavatam reference 4.11.18. So from Kala's, Paramatma's play with his time energy, then the Atma, the Jiva, who is always with Paramatma, then he is taking on a svabhava. Svabhava means a nature. And that nature is related to his previous karma. Because we understand Mahavishnu is breathing out the universes again and again and again, so there's no telling, it's untraceable how long we have been here in this repeating creation, maintenance, and destruction of universes. Prabhupada says, the soul is simply termed nityabada, eternally conditioned. So we cannot trace, it's impossible to trace it out. I like to give this example. Even if we were able to trace out our karma throughout the existence of this universe, it would be something like tracing our footprints in the snow of winter. You see? So let's say we live in a very northern part of the world, and when it snows, and the snows stay on the ground. So we've been moving around that winter and leaving our footprints in the snow. Of course, there's the problem that it keeps snowing, and that's one thing that covers our footprints. But then there's a further problem that spring comes and all the snow melts. Spring and summer comes, all the snow melts. And then the next winter, another snow comes. So this is like the generation of universe after universe after universe after universe. How do you trace out your karma between one universe, the universe you're in now, and the previous universe? It's like trying to trace your footprints in the snow of this winter to that of the previous winter. There's just no way to make that connection. Of course, everything is known to the Lord, but to us little jivas, it just becomes an impossibility. So therefore Srila Prabhupada just says, accept that you are eternally conditioned, accept that you have been here since time immemorial, and there's simply no way to trace out the beginning. So don't bother with it. So karma is therefore said to be anadi, beginningless. And our svabhava, our nature, is associated with that karma. Like Srila Prabhupada gives us an example of svabhava, newborn puppies. They're blind, their eyes are shut. They have practically no control over their bodies. But still they know enough to seek out the nipple of their mother. Their mother, the mother dog, lays down. And the newborn puppies, they move their noses and their mouths in the direction of her nipples, and they know to suck the milk from her breasts. That much they know. So Srila Prabhupada explained that this svabhava is coming from two directions, this nature. This is an example of nature. You see, by nature, isn't it? By nature, the puppies, although they don't know anything else, they know that we can get milk from the teats of our mother. So this nature is coming from two directions. One is help from Paramatma. The Lord says, I give knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. And the other is past experience. That this is, there is already, because how many times have we been in such forms of life that have sought out at birth milk from the mother's breasts? Uncountable times. So that is left an impression in our subconscious mind. So then these two constitute svabhava. So there's atma, svabhava, karma, and of course prakriti, which is the energy of paramatma. So this is the verse reference to that. And so from this, the interaction of paramatma, kala, atma, svabhava, karma, and prakriti, there appears the Mahatattva, which we spoke about on Friday, which is the staging ground of material existence, material creation. And the Mahatattva has two features, avyakta and vyakta. So the avyakta Mahatattva, that is the Mahatattva in which Lord Mahavishnu lies down. It is avyakta, means there's no manifestation there. It is only pradhan, the ingredients of material nature which are not yet formed. And what is the experience of that avyakta mahatattva? Well, it is actually something that we cannot experience. But Srila Prabhupada says, from the Lord's point of view, it appears as a dark cloud somewhere in some corner of the spiritual sky. In the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami says this abhyakta can be experienced by the jiva, but only as shunya, as void. So, for example, the Buddhists, or many among the Buddhists, that's their goal. Therefore, Buddhist philosophy is called shunyavad. Their goal is to experience nothingness. They don't accept that there's a soul. They accept consciousness is only the result of material combination, the combination of what they call five skandhas, which is something very much like the five mahabhutas. And these five skandhas combine, and then there's the experience of this material world. So you break down the five skandhas by negative meditation, and there will be nothing left. Shunya. which is literally translated means zero. Shunya, just like ekka is the number one, so before ekka is shunya, which means zero. So Shukadeva Goswami says that the avyakta mahatattva, or the avyakta unmanifested material nature, is experienced by the jiva as shunya, because it has no form. It's formless, so if the jiva's consciousness enters into it, there's nothing really to experience. So, this also is called susupti. When we have dreamless sleep at night, our consciousness is also passing through that avyakta stage. So, there's no dream, there's just emptiness, blackness. So avyakta mahatattva, and then when Garbhadaksha Vishnu expands from Mahavishnu, then that mahatattva becomes vyakta, or manifests a form. What is this form? These are the Shodasha Kala, the 16 basic ingredients of material creation, starting with the mind. Then there's the Jnanindriyas, 5 kinds of knowledge acquiring senses, Karmindriyas, 5 kinds of active senses, and then 5 kinds of sense objects. That adds up to 16. So then out of Mahatattva comes, you see, when the jiva enters Mahatattva, Vyakta Mahatattva in particular, then Ahamkara appears. He becomes attached. He becomes attached to material existence. So Ahamkara makes its first appearance. And this Ahamkara then divides into 3 Shaktis. The Jnana Shakti, the power of knowing. The Kriya Shakti, the power of activity. And the Dravya Shakti, the power of physicality. These are known, we should know these terms, Adidaiva, Adhyatma, Adibhuta. So Adidaiva refers to controlling deities. The Adhyatma refers to the living entity himself, the spirit soul, the jiva. And Adibhuta refers to physical nature. And so then, this is a transformation of Ahamkara. This is what you're seeing. Transformation of Ahamkara. First there's the primordial Ahamkara, then it transforms into these 3 Shaktis, and then out of there comes 3 types of Ahamkara. So, Vaikarika Ahamkara, otherwise known as the Sattva Guna, the mode of goodness. Tajasa Ahamkara, otherwise known as the mode of passion. And Tamasa Ahamkara, otherwise known as the mode of ignorance. So what emanates out of the Sattva Guna or Vaikaraka Ahamkara are the mind and the sense devatas. So the mind devata is Chandra, the deity of the moon, who is representative of Lord Aniruddha. We told you about Lord Aniruddha Pradumna Sankarshan and Vasudev on Friday. So Chandra is, in the material world, the lord of the mind of the living entities. And therefore the mind is called chanchala, unsteady, because the moon also goes through its phases. Sometimes the moon is in its purnima phase. So, purnima, it means full moon, so the mind is fully in the mood of goodness, or seems to be, anyway. Sometimes our mind is very peaceful, very, you know, spiritually inclined. But then as time passes, the mind, the moon starts to shrink to half size, quarter size, or three-quarter size, half size, one-quarter size, and finally becomes Amavasya, the dark moon, or new moon as it's called. Sometimes you can see it in the sky. You can actually see, it looks like a black orb hanging in the sky in the night, if the rest of the sky is lit up enough. That's Amavasya, the dark moon. So the moon is chanchala, subject to the phases of time, or in other words, subject to the changes of the modes of nature. And then we have these other demigods, Dik, the demigods of direction. And over here, under Kriya Shakti Tejasa Ahamkara, the subtle senses, buddhi, intelligence, and the prana, the life airs. So, and then buddhi, intelligence, and the subtle jnanendriyas, the subtle knowledge acquiring senses. So, here in the mode of goodness, the demigod Dik, the controller of the directions, is the lord of the ear, hearing. And the object of hearing is, of course, sound. This is the perception. And the substance that is the ear is coming in contact with is ether, akash. Then there's the demigod Vayu, mode of goodness. He is the lord of the eye, which is in the mode of passion. Skin. Yes, Vayu, skin. Right. Skin picks up the sensation of touch, which is arising from the mode of ignorance. And touch is the indicator of the substance air, which is also produced from tamasa ahankara, tamoguna. Then Surya is, in the mode of goodness, is the lord of the eye, in the mode of passion. And the eye sees rupa, or form, which is an indicator of the substance, fire. Varuna is the lord of the tongue. The tongue detects taste, and taste is the indicator of the substance, water. Yasvini Kumaras, they rule the nose. The nose detects the sensation smell, which is the indicator of the substance or the element earth. And then also under the same, coming out under the same Taijasa Ahamkara, we have this subtle prana, which is ruling the subtle karmendriyas. And here we have another set of demigods in the mode of goodness. And what they control, the senses they control, which are in the mode of passion. So Agni rules the voice, Indra rules the hand, Upendra rules the feet, Prajapati rules the genital, and Mitra rules the anus. And over here are the corresponding Bhagavatam references, where you can find all of this explained. So do we have any questions on this?
About the time.
What?
About the time.
Time.
Unmanifested situation, substance, like you said, pradhan, what about the time? There's some time going on.
Yes. Yeah, well, time is eternal. But time goes through its different phases. So, when Lord Mahavishnu closes his eyes, then this is the time of Mahapralaya, the time of the devastation of the universe. So, it's interesting to note that in the Sanskrit vowels, there are male vowels and female vowels. There are 14 vowels in the Sanskrit language. So the male vowels, which stands for Purusha, and Purusha indicates forms of the Lord. So there's the beginning A, which stands for Vishnu. A is Aprameya, he's all-pervading. Vishnu means he dwells everywhere. And the seventh male vowel, the last male vowel, is O, which stands for Sankarshan. Sankarshan is that form, that Vyuhamurti from which Mahavishnu expands. So Sankarshan is the end. Vishnu is the beginning, and Sankarshan is the end. Of course, they're not different. But, as I said, Sankarshan is also known as Sadashiva, the destroyer. So Vishnu is the, by his glance, he opens his eyes and glances over material nature, sets it into motion. He's also the maintainer. And Sankarshan is the destroyer. He closes his eyes and everything dissolves. And that letter O, standing for Sankarshan, one of the interpretations of the letter O is Odana, which means pudding. When Lord Sankarshan closes his eyes, then the whole cosmic manifestation turns into pudding. In other words, it means like a rice pudding, something that's boiled into mush. And then it all enters into Sankarshan and he digests it. So that's the time of Mahapralaya. So there's only Sankarshan existing. Everything else is just within him in potential. So that is for the duration of one of his ingoing breaths. And then he breathes out. And when he breathes out, then that is the time of creation. So this breathing out time is measurable time, you see, because then we can measure the manifest, you know, everything comes into being. There's this great cosmic clock, which since ancient times they have calculated time by observing the movements of the heavenly bodies. But when the Lord breathes in, time is eternal, but that time is immeasurable. Because there's no, if we're part of that, if we're drawn into the body of Mahavishnu, then we're just merged into total unconsciousness and experiencing only shunya, nothingness. So we have no sense of the passage of time. Of course, time is always there. Krishna says, because I am time, so he is time. He is, the Bible says, he is Alpha and Omega, A and O, the beginning and the end. In the Sanskrit alphabet, the Lord is A and O, the beginning and the end. The same thing is there. So finally, it is the Lord himself who is time. Anything else? Yes?
You said Jnana Shakti is the knowledge potency.
Yes.
Kriya Shakti is active.
Yeah.
And the third one?
Dravya Shakti is physicality.
Can you explain?
Yeah. Here's something physical. That's Dravya. Matter, solid. Or gaseous. You see, because this becomes the tanmatras. The sense perceptions and Mahabhutas, the five elements. So, ether, so starting with earth, this is earth. Then there's water. This is, in other words, solid matter. Then there's water, liquid matter. Then there's fire. Matter is radiant energy. Then there's air, gaseous matter. Then there's ether, which is the subtlemost manifestation of matter. It's too subtle for material scientists to detect. But in ether are the potentials of the others. Ether is the space beyond space. It is actually matter as dimension. So modern science has calculated, theoretically, I believe, mathematicians have calculated up to 20 dimensions. We live, they say, in three dimensions. You see, there's length, and there's height, and there's breadth. This is what we call three-dimensional space. But so theoretically, mathematicians have calculated up to 20 dimensions. So if you want to get some idea of what it's like to be in a higher dimension, well, think of lower dimension, two-dimensional space. You can draw a stick figure of a person. You see, simple head, two arms, little stick for a body, and then two legs coming out. So that's what it's like to be, to live in two dimensions. You see, there's length and there's breadth, but there's no height. You see, so if we can imagine an entity living in four dimensions, he would observe us exactly as we observe a person in two dimensions. If we can imagine a person in two dimensions, a living person in two dimensions. See, a living person in two dimensions, it's just like any piece of drawing art that's on a page. So you take in everything at once, in one glance. You know, say it's one of those anatomical diagrams of the human body where you see, you know, inside the skeletal structure, the muscles, the digestive organs, you know. So you see all of that at once. You see what's inside, you see what's outside. You see all at once. You see everything because it's only in two dimensions. You see? So you don't have to go, there is no question of going around and seeing another side. You just see everything that's there at once, because there is nothing on the other side. You see? So in the same way, a living entity in four dimensions would be able to see everything about us inside and outside at once, in one glance, without having to walk. You know, now because we're in three dimensions, if I want to see you from backside, I have to go around back and look at you from the back. You know, I have to move through three-dimensional space. But in four dimensions, in one glance, they'd see everything there is to see about us. And then in the fifth dimension, in one glance, they'd see everything there is to see about the person in fourth dimension. So anyway, like that, theoretically, mathematicians have worked out 20 dimensions. But of course, that's just in the minds of mathematicians. They haven't demonstrated it. But Akash, the reason that they're able to conceive of these other dimensions is because the mind moves in Akash. And Akash is the potential, dimensional potential. So as we will show you when we turn this around, Lord Brahma lives in the realm of Akash. The Satyaloka region is in the realm of Akash. And so therefore it is described that Brahma's palace in Brahmaloka, his assembly hall, where the demigods come to meet him, it's of a fantastic architecture that changes at every instant. Now, can you imagine this? Imagine the most incredibly fantastic, gigantic, you know, tremendous proportions, millions and millions of stories high, and covering millions and millions of acres square, the most fantastic Vedic temple that you could ever imagine. But at every instant, its whole architecture is changing. Like that. So that's what happens in the level of Akash, because it's the potential of dimension. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada says, for example, in one purport, this is why we can send television images, because they're traveling through Akash from one place to another. The Akash is carrying the potential of those images, and thus they're receivable and perceivable to us in another place. Yeah, so anyway, that's what ether is. If I made it clear, or if I didn't make it clear, sorry. But anyway, that's